So welcome to VentureCast. I'm Craig Severson of Grunt Media.
And I'm David Hornick from August Capital.
And this, in a sense, is a resurrection of VentureCast. I missed it. And you know, David did a few months ago, and then he stopped. Why'd you stop?
Well, you know, I guess I wasn't driving up 280 enough without phone calls to make. I mean, VentureCast was the result of me having a little digital audio recorder that, right, I had in my pocket. And if I had enough minutes and something to say, then I would record a little VentureCast and then stick it on the computer when I got home. And I guess I got too busy driving on making phone calls. So.
Right. Well, you wrote a nice theme song, too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Welcome to VentureCast.
But we won't do that.
Okay,
we won't sing for you.
Never again.
But so what we're doing here, this is sort of, you know, VentureCast 2.0. I'm just going to say that once. I won't say that ever again. But what I want to do was come in and take the stress of the production thing off of David's hands and come into his office. And every couple of weeks or so, we're going to get together. I'm going to sit him down, and we're just going to talk about stuff.
Perfect.
Because I miss the venture capital thing. I mean, I miss sort of the new company thing, having kind of been immersed in that professionally for the past 12 years, working at Frog Design and then IDEO. So I found myself like, I don't know what's new anymore. So that's one of my motives here, is to sort of, you know, keep abreast.
Great. No, I mean, one of the great things about this job is that people come in and tell me the really new cool stuff they're working on.
Yeah.
And that's my job. I mean, how good is that?
I know. It's a blast. So, and we really haven't spent a lot of time thinking about this. We just sort of decided we'd wing it and go with it. So we're working on the format. I think we're going to, you know, mostly it's going to be about a conversation about venture, about what's on David's mind. I'm a complete newbie in this. So I'm going to be asking some really dumb questions now and again, just to sort of get clear about what it means when you start talking technical. I wouldn't say neutral, but just sort of a beginner's perspective. And then we'll see, you know, we'll let the audience, you know, let us know what you think. Let us know if you want us to talk more about, you know, what's in David's brain, which can be very scary, or if you want to learn more about venture capital or how to get funding or whatever. We're open to that.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think the great thing, when I started VentureBlog, it's almost, I guess, 3.5 years ago, the idea was, oh, gee, there are a bunch of things about venture capital that people don't know, and there isn't really a good way to find out about it, so maybe I'll write about those things. And so early on, I wrote, oh, here's a term sheet, and what do you do when you present to a VC, and all those things. Well, now they're, you know, deep in the inner recesses of VentureBlog, and I don't know who can find them. Maybe I should rewrite those things if people care, but I'm happy to talk about any of that.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Well, one day maybe we'll do Venture Grunt. You know,
that'll go.
I also want to say, in terms of, you know, for me, one of my early experiences of podcasting was the venture capitalist talking. So a huge thank you and kudos to John Ferrier and PodTech for all the work they've done in just really getting a lot of these people out there and you know, on mic. It's been great.
Yeah, you know, in fact, I was I had the good fortune of being one of those early conversations with John, and it's great to see what's happened with John and the company, and now with Mr.
Cool.
Scobel joining them.
Yeah.
So that's awesome.
Yeah, and also to Eric Olson for Venture Week, his weekly update on funds and just sort of the bigger picture. That was always very cool to hear. And Greg's show,
Venture Voice,
which is also awesome.
Yep.
So we're providing the venture voice of David.
That's right, exactly. So if you don't like it, this show will rot.
It's not our fault.
We want another VC. Can you bring in another VC? Nope. Sorry. This week David Hornick, and next week, it's David Hornick.
Again.
Oh man.
So, is venture dead?
His venture dead.
Seven Rosen thought it was dead, right?
Man, they seem to have thought it was dead, at least for the time being. So that's something, isn't it? Well, I don't think so. And I still come in. I wake up in the morning and drop off the kids at school, and then I go and do venture. So now, of course, that doesn't really answer the question, because we already have an existing fund. We've got some money to put to work, and I can invest in things, and I can lose it as well as anyone else.
Yeah.
So maybe that doesn't answer it. But yeah. I don't think so. I mean, my view of it is, there are lots of interesting technologies. There will always be lots of interesting technologies. And so will there be winners in any given year, in any given market? You bet there will be. And technology is absolutely a monstrous mover of the economy. And so how can there not be a business in funding early stage technology businesses? There has to be.
Mm-hmm.
So now there are lots of open questions, and I give Seven Rows in that. I think it's a reasonable question to raise, which is there's lots of money. There are lots of venture firms. It costs less to build internet companies. It doesn't cost a lot less to build, say, a hardware business or a chip business. So they still are pretty capital intensive.
Mm-hmm.
So, but even given all those open questions, you know, you bet. I mean, I think that there will be opportunity to fund the YouTubes and Facebooks and Skypes and, you know, Googles of this world. And when you do fund those companies early on and they become big, important businesses, then you make a lot of money for your investors.
Right. Now, were they questioning more the idea of, is the actual model of venture capital the problem? Not that there aren't companies around, but that the model of venture is flawed.
No, absolutely. I mean,
did they return the money back to the...
So, you know, it's a kind of a funny thing. I mean, here's a little, you know, mini lesson on venture capital.
Okay.
But I mean, the way venture capitalists raise a fund, mm-hmm. when you raise a fund, is not to actually collect a bunch of money.
Mm.
What you do is you collect commitments to raise a bunch of money. So you say to your investors, who are foundations or universities or big rich individuals, whatever, you say to them, we're raising a $500 million fund, and we would like you to Yale University to invest $100 million in our fund.
Okay.
And they say, okay, we'll do that. That sounds great. And then you sign a contract that says that they have an obligation when you ask them to give you money up to $100 million.
Okay.
And then over a period of time, you write them a letter and say, hey, Yale, we've finished using the last bit you gave us.
Uh-huh.
So can you send us another $10 million? So what Seven Rosen did was they were out in the process of getting those commitments. They were out saying to their existing investors and others, will you commit to invest a certain amount of money? And those investors had committed, I think, $400 million towards their existing fund. Mm-hmm. And what they gave back was the obligation. They said,
you know what?
We've changed our minds and we're ripping up the contract. You are no longer obligated to give us the $400 million over a period of time because we don't know that there's a way to put it to work.
I see. So they didn't start investing it yet either, right?
Nope, they haven't done anything. Informing a venture partnership, first thing you do is you get together with a group of people and say, who are the partners that are going to invest this money? And those are the general partners. So in my partnership, there are five investing general partners, and we sat around and said, okay, we'll go raise a fund, and the five of us will be the general partners who are investing this money.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go out to your limited partners, the folks who are your investors, and say, hey, we're hoping to raise a fund of X million dollars, $500 million. Are you interested? And then they come in and say, yes, we're interested.
And the limited partners are these cash-rich things like university endowments or retirement funds. Is that what you're saying?
Right, exactly.
Okay. Insurance companies probably have...
There are pension funds. Mm-hmm. There are, you know, so any entity, they're a fund of funds. They're actually funds that collect and that raise money from other investors and then invest their money into venture funds as well.
Okay.
So once you've collected up commitments for that fund, then you say, okay, we're now going to collect the first piece we're going to put to work. So all of you who've committed, please give us the first 10% of the amount you said you'd give us.
Okay.
And now you have 50 million of your $500 million fund in your bank account. And then you talk with companies and find things to fund. And then you use that 50 million to fund them.
Okay.
So I think they had, as I understand it, they had commitments to raise the money. They had not collected the money, and they ripped up the contract and said, we're not going to do this now because we don't think that we can take your $400 million and make it into $401 million, never mind $800 million or $1.7 billion or whatever.
So what are they going to do? Isn't that their business?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting question, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they have existing funds
that they're
investing, and the typical life of a fund is a 10-year fund. So
mm-hmm.
if you raised a fund in 2000, then you're gonna invest it between 2000 and 2010.
Okay.
And so you know, they have a few years to continue to invest their existing funds. And I think, and they've said they're going to continue to manage the investments they've already made. And perhaps in the future, they'll decide that the environment has changed enough to raise more. But for the time being, they're not going to take more money in and do new investments.
Got it. Now, there's management fees also involved. Is that true?
That is true.
Yeah, the general partners or venture firms charge a management fee to for the overhead of doing this, right?
Right. Well, yes, the overhead, you know, however you measure the overhead. But in reality, the way that management fees work in most instances, it's a percentage of the total amount of money that you have that you have commitments for. So
okay.
It's not the $50 million that you have in your bank account. It's the $500 million that people have committed to invest. And so you collect, you know, a percent or two of that pays for operations. It pays for staff and flying around to board meetings and those sorts of things.
Yeah. Right. So then if I understand it, a few weeks ago, they sort of made this announcement. It sort of created buzz. And then like a few days later, the YouTube thing happened. Is that right?
Or yeah, there
like,
you go.
Right after that, it's like, wow. Okay. So is it dead or?
Right. Well, exactly. I mean, and that's a great example. Now, of course, I think that people would say, gee, you know, if we all knew that we could find a YouTube, then it'd be a great business.
Yeah.
And so the challenge is how many YouTubes are there?
Sure.
And how many funds are there chasing after those number of YouTubes or Skypes or whatever?
Right.
And so a perfectly fair question, but I think the answer is that there'll always be a number of them, and there'll always be a number of successes, and there'll be a number of big successes. And so the job of, you know, that my job is to find a disproportionate number of those.
Yeah.
Right.
And right.
The venture capitalists that find a disproportionate number of those, they're good. They're good at their job, and they will be able to raise more money and make more money and all of that. And those venture investors that find a disproportionate number of the things that fail will not raise more money, will not, and, you know, and they will be the VCs who are not as good.
Yeah.
So, I'm confident that August Capital's had a long period of time where it's invested money and made money for its investors and found interesting companies, you know. And so I'm confident that we'll continue to do that. So I, you know, when we finish investing this fund, then we'll go raise another.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
and we'll find interesting stuff to invest in from that fund too.
Were you surprised with the YouTube thing or the amount or anything like that?
I guess no. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I think it was a really rational decision. And
mm-hmm.
I guess I congratulate Google because it was a great acquisition. It was really. Now, I have one small caveat. I mean, there's this incredible open question
mm-hmm.
about whether or not they will be able to avoid being sued over this copyrighted material that exists on YouTube. We all know it exists.
Right.
It exists in great quantities. And looking back not too long ago, there was another company called Napster that had
right.
this very same issue. There was there were great quantities of copyrighted material that were being traded in a way that was not legal, and they were unable to rely on the same exemption that YouTube is now relying on,
right.
which is this, you know, Digital Millennium Copyright Act. The DMCA says, gee, you know, as long as you agree to take stuff down when copyright holders tell you that they own it, then you can't be sued by the copyright holders because you've allowed that, you know, you've given them the opportunity to give you notice and takedown.
Yeah.
So that was true when Napster existed as well, only it didn't protect them. And so the interesting question is for YouTube, are they going to be able to enter into agreements with content companies quickly enough so that they don't get sued by them?
Yeah.
Right. And that's a challenge.
I mean, I've been impressed. They seem to have a real crack legal team there at YouTube because they've really done some things that have been pretty smart and kind of ridden this whole thing pretty well. And when they talked about, I think it was with Warner Brothers or, you know, make a deal if something
Warner's,
is shown.
Warner Music.
Yeah.
Yep.
I thought that was really smart. That's
no, they've
one
done,
way,
they've done
one
a great
way to,
job.
You know, to deal with the issue, but make it a win-win.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, if there is the challenge for a YouTube or any of these companies, I'm an investor in a company called VideoEgg, and VideoEgg is a video service provider for lots of the social networks. So when you put a video up on Bebo or on HiFive or on Tagged, VideoEgg is the service managing the back end. And for sure, those services are going to get paid for by advertising that supports them. That's true of YouTube. It's and it's true of all of these services, because I haven't seen to date one that's a subscription service.
Right.
So, if that's the case, then can you make enough revenue to pay the content owners, to pay and to maintain the necessary economics to afford the bandwidth and all of those things, right? So that's what we're all jostling with, is figuring out how those economics work and how much money can you give to Warner for their music video and still have enough money to maintain operations and all of those things. But I think we'll get there. I mean, I think that media companies understand there's a real new revenue source, there's a real distribution source, it's great publicity, and that digital distribution is really the way, the thing they need to embrace and figure out how to make money. And so YouTube's really done a good job of leading the chase on that. More power to them. And I think congratulations to Google for having focused on that and realized that, you know, the curve is unbelievable. The number of videos they're serving today is only going up tomorrow.
Yeah.
And, and I don't think that's slowing down anytime soon. I've been stunned at the migration of video. You look at something like Video Egg, which has gone from, you know, thousands of videos to tens of millions of videos being served a day in less than a year since I invested.
Wow.
So that's, That's just an astonishing thing. It's driven by the incredible desire for video content, and also for the fact that we have video bandwidth that makes it possible and all.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, as you know, right,
sure.
Your Video Grunt podcast, which is trying to teach us all how to make great stuff as opposed to mediocre stuff, right?
Right.
I mean, video is important, and it's not going anywhere. And I couldn't be more enthusiastic about the space. And I think that Google, you know, did a good job of buying the leading company when they could.
Sort of the tide broke for me in realizing that there was a lot of opportunity here when the bandwidth got to a certain level, and when Apple started making it a little bit easier with including videos in their podcast directory. All of these things converged suddenly to like make it really possible. And as an independent producer, I'm stunned that, you know, a year or two ago, I couldn't have done what I'm doing now, which, you know, I sit at home and I'm thinking about, I'm about to finish up my latest podcast. And I think, you know, in 20 minutes, there's going to be tens of thousands of people watching this video. And I'm sitting here eating my breakfast right now. But then, you know, suddenly it's going to go out there because, you know, distribution is no longer an issue. So
it's stunning. And I mean, that was the same realization I had with blogging early on.
Yeah,
You know, that the fact that RSS made blogs accessible to lots of people, and that it was very simple to subscribe to. And, you know, now, despite the fact that I write VentureBlog infrequently and too infrequently, my apologies, I have 40,000 RSS subscribers.
Yeah, yeah.
And so to them, they don't have to keep going back to a website and saying, oh, well, Hornick hasn't written anything new. They just go to their aggregator and every so often, you know, oh, there's something on VentureBlog, I can read it. And that's fine. Then it's fine, right? If there was no RSS, the fact that I write every, you know, week and a half or two would be incredibly frustrating. And it would mean that I'd have three readers, not, you know, not thousands. And so... So, I mean, these distribution technologies are just spectacular, and I think getting better and getting more mainstream, and so that's great news.
And also, when we start to get movies online in a reasonable way, for me, I think that's going to be the big shift in the general consensus of the population, when they realize that every single piece of media that they can get is now coming through the computer, whereas before, there was always the exception of the movie you had to get on DVD or go to the theater, and before it was television, and then, you know, I had to go to TiVo, or I had to, you know, tune in at the right time. And now everything is completely time shifted and space shifted. And I think once that gets firmly going, the download of movies, that I think the general population is going to really then be open to all of these other video sources and you know, alternative providers out there.
No, absolutely. I mean, then these movie theaters better figure out how to make virtual reality movie theaters quickly, or something that you can't experience in your home.
Yep.
You know, that said, the movie experience is still one that is different than when it's viewed on a giant screen than when it's viewed in even the most beautiful of home theaters.
Right.
So there is some advantage there. And the reality is that the economics for movies really aren't about necessarily about theater distribution. They're not about theatrical release as much as they are about all of the distribution channels after that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't think the theaters are going away, but I do think that the migration, I mean, this is a challenge for the DVD business. It's certainly
obviously,
you know, goodbye to Blockbuster, which we're already seeing happening incredibly quickly. I mean, but I agree with you. I mean, that everything for my children is about the computer.
Yeah.
That they go to their laptops to experience all media types, and they truly do. I mean, you know, I have one son, a 9-year-old, who wakes up early every morning. He just doesn't seem to need to sleep. And when I go in his room, he's very quiet. Why is he quiet? Because he's sitting at his computer. He's looking at skateboarding videos, or he's checking out, you know, his e-commerce or whatever, you know, skateboards for sure.
Yeah, so. Right. Cinema's always had this challenge, and they've always overcome it. Like in the 50s, when television came about, you know, there was this big hue and cry that you know, people wouldn't go to movies, and they figured it out. I mean, they went widescreen. But in the end, it's also a social experience, and it's a, you know, we're apes, and we want to be out in the world now and again. We're not all hermits. And so for me, the idea, if the cinemas are going to, you know, the part that they can leverage is the fact that it is a social experience. And for many people, that's the reason they don't want to go, is because of the badness of that social experience. So I really feel if there's a way that cinemas can come up with ways that make that whole experience social and pleasurable, serving food or changing the seating or something, I think there's a real shot at it to, you know, keep it viable.
Now look at these, you know, I guess it was Byrne, one of the guys over at Six Apart, who blogged about taking his new baby to a movie theater that allowed babies, how they have baby night and it became this community event, because who goes? Well, they're new parents, right? Yeah. That go to this movie, and so they all are in sort of this shared social space. They all are new parents. They used to watch lots of movies. Now they can't watch movies, and they show up with their babies, and they put up with sort of the noise of babies, to experience the movie, but also to like hang out with a bunch of people who would take their babies to the movies.
Yes.
Right? And that's great. I mean, you know, I'm a monstrous fan of Broadway, and I think you can't replace Broadway. It is this live theater experience.
Right.
Now, there are all sorts of things that have happened in Broadway to try and make it this more cinematic, more, you know, immersive experience. And yet I went to see this show relatively recently called The Drowsy Chaperone. And The Drowsy Chaperone is the most traditionally sort of sweet, non-cinematic, non-extravaganza-like show, and just immensely entertaining. So I think that for all of time, entertainment will trump production value.
Right.
And so I think that will, and so I don't think all things will become an experience that you live in your virtual reality glasses or whatever, but in other ways, I'm really pretty pleased that things that digital media, that analog media is making its way to digital media and becoming available when you want it, when you need it, all that stuff. So that's great news.
And it opens up different types of media. Podcasting has opened up this short form video, like what I do, that really wasn't possible or very practical before. But now it makes a lot of sense to do a 5-minute video, whereas before it never would. And now we can do a 20, 30, 60 minute audio show. We don't care about time. You and I aren't caring about time right now, which is wonderful. You know, we don't have to hit a spot, you know, or a 28 minute thing. It's really opening up formats and different ways in which different stories to be told in different ways.
Right. No, absolutely. And I mean, you know, God forbid we should get through our first reborn VentureCast without saying long tail. But I mean, you know, the reality is there are all sorts of audiences for all sorts of content.
Yep.
And, you know, how many people would be listening to a venture capital radio show driving down the road?
Yep.
Right? Would you really get 8 a.m. 7:40 to be venture capital talk?
No,
you know, you wouldn't. But but there's certainly at least 7 people who want to hear this.
That's fine with me. Yeah.
Right. So, and if they could all just, you know, comment on the thing, let us know what you want to hear about. That'd be great. We're catering to you, at least 6 of you. I think the seventh of you is my mother. And, you know, mom, get a grip. This is not for you. This is very boring for you.
Brings up a thought that I've been thinking about with back to YouTube and that is there room for the second tier players? It seems like it's kind of becoming a winner take all. I sort of think of MySpace. I think of and certainly YouTube, where, you know, there's a lot of other video sharing companies out there. Now, obviously, they got traction and they weren't necessarily first. But, you know, as an investor, how do you feel about that? You know, these huge deals like this one, and then what happens with the second tier companies?
Right. Well, you know, as an investor, you never view your investments, right, like the secondary, right, companies, like your children are never ugly.
Exactly.
You know?
Right.
So, but it is true, right? There are market leaders, and then and is there a premium over the next ones? And is the premium so great that it's hardly worth owning the second one versus the next one, right?
Right.
So for me as an investor, I invest so early that who knows what's the winner, right? Yeah. So at the time that that MySpace was getting funded, Friendster had already been funded, and everybody thought Friendster was the winner, right? Like, oh my God, Friendster's the hands-down winner. It's growing so quickly. Mm-hmm. And then they had technical problems. They had other issues. And meanwhile, you know, MySpace sort of quietly grew its user base, which the nice thing about social networks is they're exponential. You know, for each person who connects, they connect to a bunch of other people who then connect to a bunch of people. And so there is certainly a premium in the online space on being the biggest, because you get bigger more quickly,
sure,
right? As long as you have some percentage growth, right? The percentage, if it's the same percentage, but the base is bigger, then you're doing better. Now,
right,
that said, you know, look at Facebook, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Facebook is, let's say Facebook is the second, you know, it's, mm-hmm, it's the second rate, you know, property behind MySpace. Well, Facebook is a really interesting company. It's a really interesting network. For college students, it is the network.
Right.
You get there and everybody is on it, and it's the way you communicate. It really has created this new communications platform for a whole swath of the American population.
Right.
And so, incredibly valuable and clearly valuable, because they're, as has been rumored, people are talking about an acquisition at $1 billion+, and the company saying, you know what, we're not ready to be acquired for $1 billion. Like, that, you know,
mm-hmm,
if they were offered $10 billion, would they be acquired? You know, maybe, you know, but no one's offered 10 billion, but at a billion, they don't seem ready to sell. Right. So Facebook's interesting because it hits a particular demographic. It's appealing. It's high frequency. It's a very understandable demographic. But you know, then even Facebook says, "Gee, you know, we're going to open up to a larger market. We're going to open up to teenagers. We're going to open up to the bigger world."
I thought that was not a good idea.
No,
initially.
You don't think so. Well, it'll be interesting to watch, right? I mean,
right,
I can assure you that the folks at Facebook had a lot of heartburn over whether to do that, and
right,
it'll be interesting to see. But you know, then you look at these other social networks, look at, you know, Dogster and Catster, right?
Mm.
You know, they now have 400,000 registered animals on
okay,
Dogster and Catster,
right,
which is a lot of users. And now presumably the users are actually the owners of the pets, but yeah, they're in the form of, you know, my dog, Charlie, and his,
right,
and not my dog, Charlie, but
right,
if I had a dog, Charlie, I'd put him up on Dogster because I love Dogster. And these guys are fanatical about it. They have their puppy pals and they love it, and they like talking about their life in the context of their pets.
Yeah.
And so these are a group of people who are a great vertical. And if you're a Purina dog chow or a pet insurance company or a dog grooming company, or, you know, these are the folks you want to get to.
Sure.
And so they're valuable audience. Are they as big as MySpace? No. And so, you know, would it make sense to have, you know, $200 million investment in a Dogster? Probably not.
Mm-hmm.
But still a valuable company and going to grow and I believe make money for its investors and be valuable resource for the dog owners. So,
yeah. Yeah. My comment about Facebook wasn't based on any deep knowledge or
yep,
insight, because that's not my business. But my feeling was that it was this really strong vertical, and it had a loyal vertical audience, and it was almost a club. And so it had a quality container around it.
Right.
And when I heard that they wanted to go wider, you know, I understand increasing numbers is a good thing, but it just seemed like it was going to dilute this, what I thought was their primary leverage point, was that controlled audience.
And it may well, right?
Right.
I mean, it'll be
very interesting,
right? I mean, the question is, will college students be less inclined to join Facebook and have large amounts of their online communications take place through Facebook by virtue of the fact that anyone can get on?
Right.
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 You know, it was only the only reason I could get on before was because I had a stanford.edu address because I teach over at the B School.
Right.
You know, which didn't seem to qualify me. Oh, great, the professor can get on, whatever. but now I could use my Yahoo account. So.
Right. I got a basic venture question then. In terms of Facebook, I'm assuming they're venture funded?
Yeah.
So someone offers them $1 billion and they say no. Do their venture investors have a say in that? Could they say, hey, yes? Or does it depend on the equity position? How does that work?
No, it absolutely, it depends on, you know, when you buy stock in a company, then you get certain rights that are associated with those the stock that you buy. And it's really just a contract, right? It says that I'm going to buy 20% of your company, 25% of your company. And along with that, I get the following rights. I get to sit on the board of your company. Mm-hmm. I get to decide whether we raise debt, those sorts of things. And one of the things that you talk about is an acquisition. Should the company be acquired or not?
Yeah.
And but it's usually in the negative form. It's any acquisition must be approved by me. Mm. Which is different from any acquisition can be forced by me. Right?
Okay.
And so in reality, unless venture investors or, you know, investors as a whole own a majority of the company and therefore can control the decisions of both the board and the shareholders, it's rare that investors have the opportunity to say, we need to do this deal despite management not thinking it's a good idea.
I see.
So now, I can say from my perspective that all of those rights, the right to say you can do it or can't do it, are sort of meaningless in the face of a management team that hasn't a particular objective, right? So if you have a management team that wants to take the company public and would rather not be acquired, telling them to go sell that company is a bad idea,
right?
Because that is not their objective. It's not their, they're not going to optimize for selling the company just because you tell them. Likewise, if someone comes to the company and says, we'd like to buy this company, and after conversations with the potential acquirer and with you about the upside and downside, et cetera, and they come back and say, as a management team, we want to sell the company, it's hard to envision the circumstance where you say, okay, I don't think that's a good idea, so no, go build the company, right? These are the folks who have to build the company. So sure, there are circumstances, but by and large, I think really it's a question of collectively coming to a decision with the management. Is there more to be gained in the future?
Mm-hmm.
And are we willing to take on the risk of potentially gaining nothing versus, a billion in the hand or billion in the bush? Yeah. Well, you know, there are risks associated with moving on. But so I think it tends to be a collective decision. I don't know what it is at Facebook. It could be driven either by the entrepreneurs or it could be driven by the investors or both. Or we'll have to wait until that book is written.
Right, exactly. One other thing I've been thinking about too is, I'm sure this is a thing you balance all the time, is the getting in early, the value being first, and holding on to something, thinking like in the photo space with Ophoto, which you're familiar with, you're their legal counsel.
I was their counsel and an advisor and big fan.
Right. And then all the other Shutterfly, which went public recently.
Just got public. And so that's pretty exciting. I mean, it was a long ride, but they built a great company.
Right. So how does that work? How does the Ophoto thing versus the Shutterfly thing work, where Ophoto got acquired right by Kodak?
Yes, by Kodak.
Somewhat early, some people say for not much, and Shutterfly rode out the dark period and came out on top. So maybe that's the big mystery question everyone wants to know, is how do you know what to do?
Sure. And me too, included, right? I mean, I would love the crystal ball, and I think you just have to sit down. I wrote this post on Venture Blog about Deal or No Deal, that goofy show where, you open a bunch of suitcases and then the banker up in the closet or whatever offers you, all right, stop opening cases and I'll give you $20,000. And you look at the cases and go, no, I'll keep going. And so it really is, I mean, in any given point in time, if someone comes and offers you a legitimate company that has stock or cash that makes sense, and you could get liquid, you could sell the company and be able to move on, make the money that's available at that time, does it make sense? You just have to look at the prospects for the business, right?
Mm-hmm.
And some of the time it makes sense and some of the time it doesn't. I mean, look at PayPal's a really great example where eBay tried to buy PayPal, I don't know, 3 or 4 times.
Mm.
And, each time eBay would come in and say, okay, we'll give you $300 million. And PayPal would say, nah, give us $500 million. And they'd say, no, we don't want to give you $500 million. And PayPal would say, well, all right, then we'll keep going, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the next time they rolled around, they'd say, okay, we'll give you $500 million, fine. And they'd say, nah, now it's $700 million.
Right.
And, and by the time push came to shove, PayPal went public. It was offered at a public price. So the price that they had to pay for it was on top of the public price that was available in the public market.
Mm.
And so they paid, $1.5 billion for the company that they could have paid $500 million for if they had been willing at the time. Now, the flip side of that is that there were a number of companies in the late 90s that were offered big dollar amounts, you know, $150 million, $250 million. And the entrepreneurs and investors said, no, this is a billion-dollar company, and look what's happening in the space or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then the floor fell out, and advertising revenue went away, and, you know, they sold for $20 million, or they went out of business, right? Look at Excite at Home. I mean, you know, holy cow. Yeah. Like, I mean, Excite and At Home were both high-flying companies, big, exciting companies, and I mean, who would have guessed that a stock could go to zero, right? I mean, you know,
yeah.
I mean, that's so low. How much blacker can it get?
Exactly. Stockholder owe us money.
Right, exactly. I'm going to have to pay you because I hold your stock. So it's an interesting question, yeah. And it's a big question. And, you know, if you're lucky enough to have it, right? Then the thing is, most startups don't even have that chance. They don't have anyone come to them and say, I want to buy you.
Right. You say if funds have a certain life. So is there a time if a fund starts to dry up, do you have to do something with your investments in companies, or how does that mechanism work?
So it's a period of time over which you're supposed to manage that money. And okay. In theory, you're supposed to have investments come to fruition over that period of time.
Yeah.
And often that's not the case. And when it's not the case, then you essentially just extend the life of the fund for purposes of managing it. So it's not, you're not extending it and your investors aren't paying you more money to continue to manage, but it's to say, we don't want to distribute the stock to our existing investors. We're going to hold on to this. I mean, the predecessor fund to August Capital was a firm called Technology Venture Investors.
Mm-hmm.
And they were investors in Jamba Juice, among other really interesting technology companies. And TVI had stock in Jamba Juice well past the 10-year mark, maybe not well past. And it was only recently that a group bought out the company and there was liquidity and they were able to distribute the money. But for a period of time past the 10 years, our partnership was continuing to manage the investment in Jamba Juice. And the same sort of holds true. Now, if the firm shuts its doors, after 10 years, there's no one left and there's no money to pay people and they say, oh, you know, we're out, then the logical thing is to distribute the stock. So you have 100,000 shares and you have 10 investors and you split it up,
yeah,
you know, whatever,
right.
Whatever the math is.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what tends to happen on Sand Hill. What tends to happen is, oh, so it's been 12 years. Boy, we wish it had been resolved by now, but you know,
we're out of here.
We're going to give it a run and hopefully in 14 years, it's worth something.
Hmm. Okay. Any other issues you want to talk about or? Something on your mind?
I don't know. So, you know, exciting time. I'm pretty excited about the YouTube business. That's great. And you know, it's great for Chad and the crew over there, and it's great for the investors. And so, you know, I'm a total cheerleader. I'm a Silicon Valley cheerleader.
Right.
I believe that that startups still work and that it's a good idea to be an entrepreneur, even though there are long odds. If you do a great job and you invent something that is meaningful and changes people's lives, that it ends up being worth a lot of money. It ends up being incredibly valuable. And maybe that's not why people do it, right? I mean, people may, you know, start a YouTube because they really want a better mechanism for sharing video, et cetera. But the fact that there is an outcome and that there is this whole economy that's based on the capacity to put money in early and put in equity and time and energy in early and have it pay off in a big way is what drives Silicon Valley. And so I think the area thrives on YouTube. I'm excited about it. I think that, you know, I look forward to each of these events because I think they're good news for the economy and they're good news for the area. So.
Excellent. All right. Well, our plan is to be somewhat fortnightly with our programs. We're thinking every couple of weeks. I also want to send out a big thank you to CashFly for providing bandwidth for this show.
Absolutely.
They're a great service and very reliable. And so I'm very pleased that they're going to be providing it for us. And until next time, we'll see you later. Thanks, David.
All right. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Junior, he's always hungry. As for Sis, she's hungry too. Our barbecue is prepared with just the right amount of heat to keep in the natural juices and hold in that wonderful flavor. Aren't they delicious? Boy, does Junior go for them. And Sis likes them too. So come on, boys and gals, let's have a barbecue.